I've deliberately not got a PowerPoint because I figured that everything I could have possibly put onto a PowerPoint slide was already going to be on a PowerPoint slide, and that's true. So we can probably turn this off.
You've got two more.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll talk about them, maybe I won't. But they might even be a bit distracting. What I want to do is actually, and to use a computer analogy, it's Control-Alt-Delete, you know, when you get to a problem, a blockage, you actually reboot your computer. And I would actually argue that climate change debate for biodiversity is a really good opportunity to do a bit of Control-Alt-Delete. Now, Control-Alt-Delete doesn't mean that you erase your hard drive. What it might mean is that you're trying to move through a blockage, just resetting everything, thinking about it. And I think really the best outcome you could expect for any group of people is just to have a free and frank discussion, because that is actually part of the adaptive process of actually thinking through these things. And so what I think, we don't need any more bad news stories. It is absolutely clear that the biosphere is going through some sort of trauma at the moment, and humans are very much involved in that trauma. It's very traumatic for everyone on the planet. All living things are in a traumatic stage. The planet has been through other traumas. We humans are in a very curious situation because we have perception, and we have a sense of future and also a sense of mortality. But we've also thought about these things independent of climate change, or maybe latently we thought about it at climate change. And so what's the basic adaptive response we have had to issues of environmental variation? What's the most basic thing we've got? It's called a nature reserve. That's really what it is. I mean, if you actually drill into what a nature reserve is, it was a statement of society to say that these systems were particularly valuable. They wanted to be set aside for perpetuity. And so you could argue that the very most basic step of adaptation to climate change is already in place for nature reserve. And you could argue that the processes which will occur in nature reserves, and all being well, society doesn't lose the stomach for nature reserves. We hold our nerve. And I might add, having been to a ministerial round table in Canberra a couple of months ago, when people are talking about offsets? Well, we need to borrow a bit of your national park, so we'll give you an offset. So, you know, I mean, let's hope that we don't sort of get into, well, it's all too hard and climate change is telling us it's all a disaster, so let's work away from the most basic adaptive response for biology and the landscape, and that's our national reserve system. But maybe the next level of an adaptive response to climate change would be to do an analysis of the reserve system. So is this actually adequate enough? You can say, yeah, we've already been doing that. But you may want to look at it in a new set of lenses and to say, yeah, the adequacy has now changed because we know that there are going to be some other threats and opportunities, challenges coming down the pipeline. And we may look at another adaptive response and to say, well, this national reserve system we've got, which we know is inadequate, and we live in a pragmatic reality, and there's lots of politicians who want to borrow parts of existing national parks, let alone expanding national parks. So we may say we've got to consider off-reserve approaches. And isn't it great that NGOs have already thought about that? So they may be a critical part of an adaptive response to climate change. And it may be that you would do that analysis and say, and we need to enhance the linkages amongst these things, which is corridors. That's another adaptive response. Now, I'm not claiming to say anything new under the sun. This has already been said in all of the existing talks. I'm just repackaging it, recapitulating. So then I would like you to consider what I've just said for Tasmania, because we've got an opportunity of an island, say, is the reserve system adequate? What could you do to enhance that reserve system? Is there an opportunity to build linkages? Is there opportunities to do something off reserve? They're the sorts of, I think, the most very basic adaptive responses, which you would need. So they're just changing gear. That one of the problems with climate change is that it involves the time dimension. And we are all trapped in the time dimension. So if we had fluidity in the time dimension, a lot of the vexatious philosophical debates, which necessarily the rancor, is climate change real? Is it really that bad? Well, if we had a time machine, we could just fast forward and go, nah, it's not that bad, don't worry about it. Or, Jesus, you want to go into the future, man? That's a nightmare. We can't do that. So there are three basic components which are required to deal with the problem of the time dimension, which I would argue are absolutely essential for any adaptation. And the first thing is the historical context. It actually turns out, when you drill into it, and I've been having an interesting correspondence with David Lindemeyer about this, is that when you actually, you know, look at long-term or longitudinal data series, any time series, they don't really exist. And then consider if some nut had made a very detailed inventory of bull kelp beds starting in 1910. Imagine how valuable that data set would be. Now, of course, for about 80 years of the bull kelp survey, they were wasting their time because nothing was changing. And that's what I would call is the miser's bottleneck. The miser's bottleneck is that a lot of monitoring which you're doing is useless because nothing's changing. But the value of monitoring suddenly increases in direct proportion to the threat of change, which is one of the great paradoxes, that there's been so little investment in monitoring and the time series. So what we ecologists with an inclination to think about history do is we use historical proxies, which are basically this side of fairy stories. But they're very compelling and fascinating and fun fairy stories, and you get to use lots of interesting kit, and you get to have lots of robust debates about inferences of time series, of these historical proxies, what this could mean. And one of Leslie's colleagues and the thing, Tim Flannery, you know, did a great job, made up a terrific story about the impacts of Aborigines on the basis of actually a few lousy radiocarbon dates and some fossil bones, because we don't have a good handle on it. So I'd argue that really good or committing to having historical data is very, very important, because you can answer the question, is the 2009 bushfire, which occurred in Victoria, anomalous? The actual answer is nobody knows. Impossible to answer that question. The trees involved, the giant eucalypts, lived for 500 years. So, you know, that's a basic regeneration event, 500 years. So in the Holocene, 10,000 years, you're only really talking about, you know, say 20 or 30 generations of that species. So, you know, how would you know whether that's anomalous? We don't know. So that leads into maybe a commitment to monitoring, maybe a really important adaptive response. And maybe you're all going, what's this guy on? You know, we're saying maybe we should actually be monitoring stuff. Just monitoring stuff, because if we're monitoring stuff, we could actually, why would you trigger an intervention if you don't know whether something important is happening? How do you know something's important and happening? So maybe monitoring is an incredibly important bridge from the inferences of history to saying, I think in these historical records, you know, there is anomalous or this is anomalous. We actually monitor it, and you go, my God. I recently published one of my students, aerobiology study we did of Hobart, and we looked into the phenology literature, and it's actually remarkable how limited the phenological data is, you know, particularly at the landscape scale. You know, there's a bloody mountain up there just crying out for somebody to take records of what the plants are doing on top of the mountain. So like an onborn, but, you know, no one's doing that. Suddenly there could be, because it turns out, because of the phenological patterns of the environmental gradient, that, you know, do we know how much wildlife is actually dependent on that phenological gradient? Which is actually migrating up and down the elevation gradient with birds. Kaboom. some tipping point happens and then, you know, suddenly all these birds start dying. Why are they dying? Oh, shit. Because they've suddenly hit a feeding bottleneck, which we weren't thinking about and nobody was even monitoring. Then I think actually the third and possibly the most, it's the show pony, but it's actually probably the weakest in some ways, is all of the modelling. You know, we're so model-driven. We've just had a, you know, all of these cataclysmic things are going to happen according to a model. They're actually not true. And they're very vulnerable to errors and they're very difficult to downscale. And they're very poorly validated or calibrated. But they're also absolutely crucial for future planning. It's not a repudiation of modelling. It's that I would argue that a key adaptive step is to take modelling and to put it into a broader landscape context and marry it with historical data and marry it with monitoring data, which would actually be enable you to help decide whether there's something important you should be actually adapting to. So let's move into the third element of adapt, and this sort of echoes, again, recapitulating what Leslie was saying. Well, what sort of adaptive responses we've got? Well, we could increase our reserve system and allow nature to do its thing. We could give a helping hand and start moving organisms around. Well, I said, the stomach for this. Many of you would know there's been tremendous debate about moving devils into habitats where they don't exist to protect them from a diabolical disease and possibly oblivion. So, I mean, who needs to be convinced that the Tasmanian devil's important? I think we all agree they're pretty bloody important. But when it gets down to starting moving around lots of organisms, imagine the philosophical tensions which are going to bubble up from doing that. There's some really, really heavy lifting to be had. And then I think, you know, again, the stomach, we have some opportunities. We're really going to be interventionist. Some paradoxical opportunities. What are all these impoundments? Imagine if we suddenly, you know, get over the fact that there was a hydroindustrialisation in Tasmania. So these impoundments actually present opportunities to mess with environmental flows in a creative way. Actually suddenly say, these impoundments are brilliant, adaptive tools to play with hydrology. Imagine if you look at some of these impoundments, particularly the shallow water ones that flood at, say, Lake Paddock. These may be crucial to conserve swamps and actually mess with soil hydrology. But do we have the stomach for this? In the west of the United States, a very key adaptive moment is occurring. As you know, there's the bud bark beetle, which is wiping out and also the conifer forests. And there's also a huge surge in crown fires. So there's been a large amount of federal money appropriated. And my former postdoc, Brett Murphy, has just been to the Black Hills of South Dakota. And it was really interesting to talk about an adaptive step. The guys are in there just mowing strips, chipping, breaking up the continuity in the crowns of these things, trying to actually reduce the impact of the fires and the spread of bark beetles. Do we have the stomach of that sort of really getting in there, you know, really getting your hands dirty and the sound of chainsaws? Because they're the sort of philosophy, I think, that we've got to deal with, that we can have the very, you know, the passive, maybe we can just enhance the reserve system, maybe we can use modelling to help guide the development of the reserve system, but we don't want to actually do translocation because that might, you know, mess with the ecology. Or do we actually want to mess with the ecology and say, yeah, we're in non-analogue conditions, let's just play and let's do tons of stuff? And that maybe leads to the final point, is that, of course, we're all in many ways not flying blind, but we're certainly flying into some very extreme turbulence. But it's not just one aircraft, it's the whole bloody fleet of aircraft. There's extreme turbulence everywhere now. So you've got all these pilots reporting extreme turbulence all at once. And what I'm hoping is that, and it's certainly something where a network like NCARF can be really useful is that I actually think the diversity of approaches and actually building the capacity for failure. Because if it's going to be punitive, you guys did this and a bad thing happened, you know, well, everybody will be transfixed into not doing anything while bad things happen. You know, I think that part of it, which is really the stomach, is actually the capacity to withstand the risk-taking. This certainly is going to be in the realm of something I'm most involved in, which is fire management. You know, and the next couple of slides I'll show you, if you... Really, the key point in fire management is that it's not only, this is this thing of this frequency curve, not only are we shifting the mean across, this dimensionless number of 2 degrees warming for a globe. 2 degrees warming for a globe, I mean, who lives in the globe? I live here. You know, that's a dimensionless number. When you actually, what we're really talking about is shifting the tails. The thing which is probably going to be our undoing is not the central tendency, it's going to be the tails, the extremes. And we're certainly seeing this, having just been to the UK, they've had this extreme winter, and now they're having an unbelievably extreme spring. I mean, what's the probability of an extreme winter and an extreme... Imagine the stress that's putting on the system hydrologically. You know, and the extreme winter actually was just very cold. There wasn't a lot of precipitation. And now there's a very limited amount of spring precipitation. So we're going to have more heat waves, we're going to have a hell of a lot more bushfires, and we're going to have concurrently, with more bushfires, reduced forest productivity. But how that will play out, we're not certain. Is it going to be reduced fuel loads, or is it going to be reduced capacity of forests to replace themselves because it's drier, but they may perversely, because of CO2 enrichment, be producing more fuel. And so this, for a fire manager, and again, you know, we're all getting squeamish about, oh, well, you know, we don't want to do prescribed burning because that burns things. Yes, it does. But if you don't burn things with prescribed burning, do we have the stomach for the high-intensity fires that may follow? And are we willing to actually, as a society or a community, deal with the risks and also the inevitable failures which are going to occur with these interventions or lack of interventions on both sides? Because, you know, let's imagine Victoria goes, we're going to go hard and burn 5% of our wildlands, which they're doing, which may actually roughly translate in just incinerating the Mallee, because it's actually burnable regularly. And let's imagine another state goes, oh, well, we're going to do the, you know, biodiversity thing, and we're going to reduce as little prescribed burning as possible. And there are certainly proponents in New South Wales who would be arguing for that. Well, you know, they haven't had a Royal Commission yet in New South Wales. But it'll be interesting, you know, these would be the interesting things. And just to round off, this, I think, is very clear. You know, I remember very vividly the terrible day that happened on 2009 when Victoria got burnt, which actually happens to be the anniversary of the fire in 1967. Since I've been back in Tasmania, was expecting that fire to have occurred here. It hasn't happened yet. But we can even see from the historical data that there is a trend in the Forest Fire Danger Index. Yeah, it bounces around. Just focus on the trend. There's an increasing cumulative effect that we are carrying an enormous amount of exposure. And that's a very specific something which I could talk at length about, in terms of the trade-offs and what sort of stomach do we have for the adaptation, which might mean more prescribed burning, more fire breaks, environmental apartheid, where we remove people from landscapes and do buybacks and tell people to bugger off because a catastrophe is coming their way, or stand back and watch the show. Thank you very much.